Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. It's August, which for a lot of us stirs up back-to-school feelings. You know what I'm talking about, that bizarre combination of relentless enthusiasm and sheer dread that would probably suggest insanity under any other circumstances. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on Central Standard, we're going to explore back-to-school season from a particular perspective, that of English language learners and their teachers. English language learners are those students who will begin the school year looking for their lockers and trying to find their classrooms just like everyone else. But on top of that, they'll need to learn a whole new language. Today's guests know the scenario well, so let's turn to them. First, I'd like to introduce Allison Heil. She's Director of Language Services at Kansas City Public Schools. Hi, Allison. Thanks for being here today.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So classes start today, right?
Yes. Yes. So, students are back to school.
I can't believe it. Thank you so much for being here on the first day of school.
My pleasure.
Set the scene in Kansas City's public schools today. What would I see if I walked down the halls of one of your schools this morning?
Well, you would see parents bringing students in, students getting off buses, some of them knowing right where to go, some of them, you know, turning a little bit in confusion or hanging on to parents, trying to find the right way down the hallway. Each school has their own procedures for bringing kids in, getting them settled, that sort of thing. But you would see a variety of cultures. We have over 43 different languages represented in the school district.
You said 43?
43, over 43.
That is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
With 43 languages, I guess there isn't a short answer to this, but predominantly, where are these students coming from?
Well, most of our current population is Spanish speakers, so we have a high population of students from Mexico, but we are also getting a large influx of students from El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, and then we have a large refugee population that's growing in the Kansas City area, and many of those students are coming to our schools. So we have Somali speakers. More recently, we're getting students from Burma, which has several languages. We have students coming from Congo, the Central African Republic, those kinds of places.
And the people entering the English language learning programs, which those are still called ESL, English as a Second Language, the program itself, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And then English language learners, that's how you refer to the students.
The students. Mm-hmm.
All right. So most of these English language learners would be pretty new to the country, I would think. Like, they didn't come here a long time ago. They're just arriving.
We actually have students that have been here since pre-K, kindergarten, that were born here, and students that are newly arriving, like maybe just even arrived last week. So we have quite a range.
Do the different ages when people enter the system affect how they are sort of brought into the system and taught the language as part of their curriculum?
Definitely. Students who enter at a younger age they'll be placed in a mainstream classroom and given a lot of language support from an ESL teacher. Students that arrive at an older age will be placed in a more specialized program because they will have missed a lot of English language instruction. And so we want to make sure that they're supported linguistically, but that they're also receiving content instruction as well. So we have specialized programs at the middle and high school called sheltered classes. And those students receive English language instruction from an ESL and an English language arts certified teacher, as well as math, science, and social studies. And those teachers are also content certified and ESL certified.
So ESL certification, that does not mean, as far as I understand it, that the teacher speaks the language of the students.
No.
Explain that, because that is just almost unfathomable to me, that someone can be trained not in how to teach a particular student from a particular linguistic background how to speak English, but that they could teach anyone, whether it's mm-hmm. someone speaking Arabic or someone speaking Spanish, such different languages.
Well, so yeah, it's English as a second language, and we're trying to teach the students English. So it isn't necessary that you speak the multitude of other languages that are going to be in your classroom. It's helpful to know another language just so that you have that background of what it feels like to be learning from another, you know, in another language. However, what an ESL teacher is trained to do is use particular strategies and techniques to make content comprehensible for a student.
Can you explain maybe a strategy, a technique that might surprise people to hear that, yeah, that this is how it works?
Some of them are pretty, you know, kind of common sense, I think, you know, we use a lot of gestures. You make sure that when you're saying something, like particularly directions, you have a visual and maybe you write down the directions. You speak more slowly. You don't have to speak more loudly, but maybe speak more slowly, maybe cut down on some of your sentences, make them a little shorter. Really, visuals and building background are a huge help for English language learners because they have a lot of experiences. They just don't know how to label those experiences in English. So if we can help build that background and help them access their prior knowledge, they can make connections to what's going on in the classroom much more easily.
So when the first day of school arrives, which would be today, what should have already happened as far as a student who's entering the school who doesn't know English? Should anything have already happened as far as either identifying that student or something else?
Well, students that have been with us, they would have already been identified when, you know, when they came in our doors. They would have enrolled with their appropriate documentation. So, you know, shot records, we verify their address so we can place them appropriately, you know, in the correct school. A newly arriving student would have come to us at Language Services where we kind of go through the orientation process. So we talk to them about the programs that are available. We give them a language screener so we know what school would be a good fit for them. We get their documentation. So for a high school student, we're looking for transcripts if they can bring them over from where they come from, and we can place them appropriately in a secondary class or secondary level. That's basically the process.
So you mentioned that some of the students these days are refugees.
Mm-hmm.
How does that affect the process you just described? Things like documentation, I would think, would be a little more challenging under those circumstances.
You are very correct about that. We actually have a very close relationship with Jewish Vocational Service. They, as a refugee resettlement agency in Kansas City, they will let us know what families are coming in. They will actually kind of collect the documentation for us and send it to us so we can start with the enrollment process for the student, getting them a student number, finding them a placement. JVS and will work with us to get make sure the students have the shots that they need so they can enter school. That's really usually one of the biggest holdups. And then once we have that information on the student, we let JVS know where they're going to be placed. We let them know what their transportation is. And JVS staff will help the families find their bus route, help get them on the bus. I think even this morning and today, there's JVS volunteers at schools helping students get to the right place. So,
how much do you tend to know about the stories that these students are bringing with them? Because some of them are likely to have been fairly traumatic and might that might be really important and useful information for a teacher who's just going to start working with this student.
Often we at in my department don't know the student's individual stories right away. What we encourage teachers to do is to find those things out right away. We do a lot of professional development on cultural proficiency and understanding the cultures within your school. Knowing more than, you know, their dress and their and their, you know, their cuisine and things like that, but knowing things like how they show affection, what's appropriate, what the family structure is, what are gender roles and things like that. So we work with teachers to either provide that information for cultures that we do know or help discover that information and cultures and communities that are coming to us. We have a lot of new refugees coming from communities that we don't have a lot of experience with, so we all have to be proactive in finding out about those.
How big is the English as a Second Language program in Kansas City, Missouri?
We actually have about 4,000 students.
Wow.
We're about 25% of the district's enrollment.
25%?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so and how long do students typically spend in the program? Because you mentioned that some of the students wouldn't have had to be identified because they've been in the program already in previous years.
So the younger a student enters our schools, usually the less time they need to spend in English as a Second Language, the program. The older you are and the less native language literacy you have, so if you've not had a school experience before, the longer you're going to be in an ESL program. So, for example, our refugee students that come to us in sixth grade and above, a lot of them have had interrupted or no formal education. So those students are going to take between 7 and 10 years to get to English language proficiency.
And then also they'd be having to catch up on all the subject matter that they missed while they were fleeing some other homeland.
Which is why we have a sheltered program for middle and high school students that have that are in those situations.
Can you define that sheltered program?
Sure. So we actually have a New Americans program, which is a self-contained classroom in middle school and high school. Those students are coming from backgrounds where they've had interrupted or no formal education. So we hold them we hold them tightly to us for about a year in a self-contained classroom where we really go over and support language development. We really need to develop their vocabularies, and we do a lot with the language of math, the language of science, the language of social studies, and just how the American education system works, how school works. Beyond that, we have sheltered classes, which students come to if they've not had English before, but have maybe had schooling in their native country. So those students, depending on their proficiency or their language screener score, so they come in and they take a language screener so we can see what their proficiency level is, they will go to a sheltered classroom. And those are the classes I was describing before where the teacher is certified in ESL and content certified, and they receive more scaffolded support.
Interesting. Well, before we go any further, let's hear more about the English language learner's experience on the first day of school by talking to someone who was once an English language learner himself. It's my pleasure to introduce Asael León. Hi, Asael.
Hi.
How are you doing?
I'm good.
So you entered the English as a second language program as a sixth grader, right?
Yeah. I started as a sixth grader. Yeah.
How long ago was that?
Actually, around 9 years, 9 to 10 years, actually.
And where were you at school?
I started at Northeast Middle.
Northeast Middle School? Yeah. And where had you come from? What brought you to Kansas City? Could you tell us a little bit of that story of your journey?
Well, it's like a typical kid, you know. It wasn't my decision to come here. It is something that probably your parents thought it would be a better future for you, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest, I'm really grateful for that. And actually, my journey was really, it wasn't the hardest one, but it was really hard for me. You know, like you guys previously mentioned, it's really hard to start out in a new country, not knowing the language, and being at that age, you know, for a small kid, it will probably be a lot faster, a lot easier. But for an older person, it's a lot harder.
Had you been in transit for a long period of time or after you left? Where had you come from?
Guanajuato, Mexico. That's there.
Had you been in Mexico very recently when you arrived here, or was it a long journey?
No. It was just short. It's nothing really.
Do you remember your first day of school?
Yeah, actually, I do.
Can you tell us about it?
It was a scary day, I tell you that. It's like for any other kid. You know, you don't know anybody. You don't have any friends or, you know. I had a younger sister, but she started in the fifth grade, so she got put in a different school. But actually, the process was really, you know, it went through really fast the first day. I got to know a few people. That's what the ESL department did for me. It's good to put people in there, you know, like you have a lot of people that speak your language, and therefore, you know, you kind of make friends along the way. You know, I had a guy that I met in my first class, and you know, he kind of guided me through the whole process. You know, he kind of took me everywhere, you know, kind of lunch, you know, different classes, you know.
Did the two of you speak Spanish with each other when you weren't in class?
Yeah.
Do you think that was a helpful thing? And not, you hear people talking about that if you don't practice it, if you aren't forced to speak it constantly, that could itself be a challenge.
To be honest, it's not really a challenge. I mean, with the classes, they tend to, like your teachers typically tend to speak to you in English. So that, like you said, like they could help you out, you know, that way you can learn a lot more, a lot faster and stuff like that. But, I mean, for the first couple of weeks, I mean, if it's a lot better, you know, for you to speak your language, get to know the people, you know. It's something necessary that you have to do, you know.
Yeah, well, it seems like if you weren't able to communicate with anyone, you could be very anxious, and that would be a huge distraction.
Right.
Well, so do you, when you think about the program itself, maybe your first year in it, what do you think you did get out of it, and what maybe do you wish you had gotten that could have been done better?
I wish I could have put more attention to it. I'll tell you that. I still remember my first year. I got pretty much all of these, or I think I got a couple Fs.
Do you think that language was the major issue there?
Yeah.
So if you were to, are there things that you think maybe people who aren't in the situation you're in are overlooking or don't recognize that might have helped you if someone had understood?
Yeah, actually, I think so. I mean, people often overlook this kind of things. You know, they don't see what other people are going through. And for us, it's a lot more challenging. I wish I could, you know, have a lot more help from other students, you know, English speaking.
Oh, so students who weren't in the English as a second language program?
Yeah.
So Allison Heil, Director of Language Services at Kansas City Public Schools, how do students integrate with the English, native English language speakers who are among them in the classes, but not necessarily in the same classroom?
Well, at the elementary level, English language learners are with their classroom counterparts or their grade level counterparts for the majority of the day. So at the elementary level, ESL teachers provide several different kinds of services. One of them is co-teaching. So the ESL teacher is in the classroom with the English language learners and the English speakers providing services. So it's not seen as a stigma when a student gets pulled out. However, depending on the student's language level, we do have that service. It's sometimes necessary, especially for our beginner students or that are new to the country, just so they can get acclimated. They might need some catch-up instruction, that sort of thing. So at the secondary level, it is a little different because students are sheltered for core content classes, but they do have their electives or support classes with English speakers.
With someone like Asael, do you, you know, he was in the program 9-10 years ago. Has anything changed since then, or would the challenge he experienced in his first year still be very much present?
You know, I think the program has changed, and the perception of the entire district has changed. We are now much more percentage-wise of the total enrollment, like I had mentioned earlier. And so schools are really taking it upon themselves to train their entire staff in ESL techniques and strategies. They are creating welcoming schools. And by welcoming schools, I mean welcoming for all families. So they're acknowledging and honoring all the different cultures that are in their buildings and celebrating that and celebrating the fact that they have students that are a diverse student population. And I don't know that that was the case when Asael was with us.
So. And you were one of Asael's teachers.
I was. I was a sixth grade social studies teacher.
Do you remember his first day too?
I do. I remember him coming in and he was super nervous and super quiet. And we expect that. You know, we know students are going to be a little freaked out.
Talk about the quietness.
Well, it's pretty normal. It's called the silent period. We expect it, you know, for up to 6 months. That's pretty normal. And what they do are what the students are doing is they're just taking it all in. They're not ready to produce anything yet. Sometimes we'll ask students to produce language, but in a group. So, you know, they don't feel put on the spot or nervous. And that's just to try and, you know, keep them comfortable. But it's okay to be silent. And we tell teachers that it's normal. And we kind of go over with teachers what the silent treatment looks like, what students are feeling, and give them that experience also. So they know what it's like to be in that student's shoes.
Asael, I hear that your teacher, Allison Heil, who was at the time in the classroom with you, gave you something that you held on to for a very long time.
Yeah, actually I did. She provided me with the picture dictionary, and it was really helpful to me. It was something that I, up to this day, I still treasure, you know. It's something that, you know, it's like she previously mentioned too, like, you might have a little knowledge about, like, the world or stuff like that, but you just kind of have to look at pictures sometimes, you know, kind of to guide you through the whole process.
You mentioned earlier that at first your grades were very poor, that you had gotten D's and maybe even an F in there. Did that change over time, or was that just a rough first year, first couple of years?
It changed really quick. Actually, on the second year, I started, you know, pulling my grades up right away. I was like, I cannot do this, you know. I came here for a reason. I'm here to, you know, make it, you know.
Allison, how common is SIL story? Is this representative of what you see in Kansas City schools, or are the success rates maybe not as good as SIL's experience would lead us to believe?
I would say SIL had a lot of support. He was a great student. I think he's underselling himself. He picked up really quickly and was an excited learner, and he has a great support system at home. His mom was very involved and, you know, was at parent-teacher conferences checking in with us. And some students aren't that lucky. You know, they have a family member, or they're here with a grandmother, or and their family members are back home. They didn't come with them. That's stressful for kids. We have some family or some students coming over now that are going to live with a family member they've never met before. So it's harder for them to get off to that good start. And what we try to do is give them the support of a great ESL teacher and a great school, and we work with those schools. I have staff that work with the schools and with all classroom teachers to make sure that they feel supported so that they can support the English language learners in their classes.
With this issue of how successful students tend to be, though, how do you measure success?
Well, the state measures success, and then we measure success kind of that way, but also anecdotally and qualitatively. So the federal government actually requires that we take an English language proficiency test. And in the state of Missouri, that's called the ACCESS test. And that test is given in quite a few states in the United States. It's a consortium. So we watch student scores on that English language proficiency test. It's a scale of 1 to 6, a 6 being native speaker-like. So we watch those scores over time. And we also look at benchmark data. So like what the district is giving as a benchmark, we watch that. We do common assessments with teachers, and we encourage teachers to monitor growth other ways.
Okay, well, let's get some broader perspective on this issue beyond Kansas City, Missouri. We'll talk with Paul Markham. He's with us by phone from KU's School of Education in Lawrence. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great. How about you?
Just fine.
How does the story you're hearing about English language learners in Missouri schools play out in Kansas?
Well, I think very similarly. I certainly wouldn't disagree with, you know, much, if anything, that Allison has been seeing. Tends to be a common kind of experience over here. And, you know, there has been a tremendous growth in the number of English language learners over the past 30 years in particular.
What do you think accounts for that?
Level. As long as the United States remains an attractive place in term, you know, economically and or for those who are, you know, facing some kind of persecution because of either their political affiliations or their race or their ethnicity or whatever it is that might cause some level of oppression, then the United States is viewed as a possible option, as a place to go where you know, they could have a better life. I would say primarily the immigration is based on economic need, but certainly there are those who come here for political asylum or because literally their religion or their ethnicity or their race is being persecuted in their home country. Those reasons are the most common.
Paul, in Kansas in particular, where are most of these, where's the influx of students coming from predominantly? Is there a place that you're seeing a lot of people from, or is it just all over the world?
Well, certainly agreeing with Allison there, they're predominantly Spanish speakers. About 79% of the English language learners K-12 in the United States in recent years are, you know, Spanish speakers, and that same profile holds up for the most part in the state of Kansas. It didn't used to be that way, having been involved in this field for some time, and I've been a professor here at KU since 1990, but, you know, had other teaching experiences prior to that, you know, in public school teaching, and once worked for the Migration Refugee Resettlement Service while I was working on my doctorate at Ohio State many years ago. But at that point, we had a lot of refugees from the Southeast Asia due to the Vietnam conflict and sort of carryover effect from that situation, and then refugees coming out of that area. But certainly, you know, recently in particular, mostly they're coming from Spanish-speaking countries, and that's also true for Kansas schools.
What is the history of ESL programs in public schools in the United States? Can you give us a little background on that?
Well, as you can imagine, you know, initially it was probably pretty much ignored. This is a nation of immigrants. It always has been. And we sort of forget that. You know, with the exception of the Native Americans, you know, everybody came from somewhere else. And so given that kind of mindset of the melting pot, the cultural melting pot, and you're coming here from all over the world and you learn our language, you learn the American way. And, you know, nobody did anything for my parents when they came here to this school, anything special. They got a special program, so we're not doing anything for you either. Well, so really hasn't been until, you know, relatively recently, you know, really not to any widespread extent until starting probably in the 60s, but really the growth of the programs for English language learners has been predominantly from that point forward, from the late 60s until now. Most of these programs have come into existence. Certainly there were sporadic attempts prior to that, but for the most part,
I'm going to let Allison Heil jump in on this. Allison, are there any milestones in this history that you'd like to point out to us?
One of the landmark cases I would say was Lau versus Nichols, which I believe is 1974-ish, and that was, it took place in San Francisco, and it was basically about 1,800 Chinese students were not being served in the San Francisco United School District system because they didn't have access to the English language. So that court case signified basically that just because a student is there and in a class doesn't mean they have access to the content areas if they don't have the English language support built in. So that kind of was one of the major cases that demanded that those students need specialized English language support.
And the repercussions of that case extended throughout the nation beyond California.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. All school districts have to have a Lau plan, actually.
Mm-hmm. And Paul Markham, how would you measure the success of these programs, and how successful do you think they are as they exist today in public schools in the United States?
Well, yeah, certainly there are lots of challenges. Again, students come here and some of them, you know, illegally, obviously, and so they're, you know, concerned about INS-related issues, and you have people who are primarily immigrating for economic-based reasons, so sometimes they also move around a lot. They're going to move to areas that are probably less expensive areas where low-cost housing exists, where they can find an ethnic community that tends to speak their language, if they can find such a community in the area. And all of those problems that have to do with low-income family life, all of those things that, you know, we understand about existing low-income students, K-12 in the United States, obviously are very much in play with most of the English language learners. And then you have to map on top of that the lack of knowledge of the language and lack of familiarity with, you know, North American cultures in many instances. So it makes it a particularly daunting task. But certainly I think that the success rate has been, you know, pretty good, you know, given the alternative or simply ignoring the problems. Still, however, the largest, you know, dropout rate for any group in the United States, you know, secondary level, is with Hispanics. And so where that's the the dominant immigrant group right now. You would have to say, based on that measuring stick, that the fact that there are a lot of dropouts among the Spanish-speaking population in the United States, secondary level, that we're not perhaps doing as well as we should in that area.
Where do you think that research could focus on improving English as a second language programs? Is there a particular obstacle that people are really working hard right now to overcome?
Well, I think Allison touched on this, but the sort of the content-based language instruction, the sheltered English type programs, the fact that you have all teachers, and the model that's being pushed now by, the PSOL type organization and NABE, the National Association of Bilingual Ed, and those that kind of look at the K-12 setting is more or less a model where you try to get as many teachers as possible in the school district and certainly within impacted buildings to pursue an ESOL endorsement.
All right.
That they're really well equipped to work with English language learners. And if you,
Paul, I'm going to have to ask you to hold this thought because we've got to take a short break. And when we return, we'll visit a local think tank run by former teachers who are trying to improve education systematically. Then we'll get back to this conversation about how our schools can best help English language learners to succeed. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today is the first day of school for Kansas City Public Schools. Those schools regained provisional accreditation last week, but 2 years without accreditation have highlighted struggles in the classroom. Two former teachers have started a nonprofit out of a desire to improve public schools. It's called the Lean Lab, and KCUR's Ben Palisari has this report.
The Sprint Accelerator is a sleek, modern communal workspace occupying two floors of an old brick building in Kansas City's Crossroads neighborhood. It has whiteboard walls and tables for entrepreneurs to sketch out their ideas. That's the sound of work getting done at the Accelerator. Actually, it's the sound of discs sliding across the indoor shuffleboard court in the space's game room. Two of the entrepreneurs toiling in the Sprint space are Katie Booty and Carrie Markle, frustrated former public school teachers. Booty says the field can drain young teachers quickly.
It's become a profession where you're so stressed. I mean, teachers are working 70, 80-hour weeks, and the focus is on the student, as it should be, to get the students where they need to be. However, because of that, I think you do see that it becomes unsustainable.
She and Markle founded a nonprofit called the Lean Lab, which helps educators and startup founders build their ideas for solving educational problems in Kansas City schools. Both Booty and Markle did Teach for America in the city, but they say that they felt burdened by some elements of working in public and charter schools. This summer, the Lean Lab gave fellowships to 5 people with ideas to improve education in Kansas City. In July, the Lean Lab hosted its first Demo Day event for their fellows to show off their ideas.
People come in with nothing more than likely than an early stage idea, and we help them flesh out a prototype.
The Lean Lab helps to get those early stage ideas into the classroom, where fellows can test them on students.
We'll help support them and partner them with mentors that are industry specific and establish those relationships.
The fellows brought the Lean Lab ideas that impact education both inside and outside the classroom. One is an online tool that allows school districts to manage enrollment in English language learning courses. Another is a mobile app that lets teachers correct assignments without paper. And one is a mentorship program aimed at girls of color. Booty says that the breadth of the fellows' ideas shows that there are many areas in education that need improvement. In all, the Lean Lab fellows have worked with more than 2,200 Kansas City students as they've grown their ideas. Michelle Foster, the executive director of UMKC's Urban Education Research Center, says that classrooms are often the testing grounds for ideas. Foster says that many researchers and universities use students as guinea pigs. So do for-profit companies like textbook publishers. But Foster says the benefit of experimenting on students is debatable. Still, the goal of Lean Lab, Booty says, is to try to give teachers the tools they need that school districts and administrators can't give them.
how do we make this profession more sustainable, I think, is the end goal. For me, at least, I can say, like I said, I would very much love to go back to the classroom in some capacity someday, but realizing that we don't necessarily, as a city, have the tools to keep great teachers in the classroom at large for a really long time.
So in addition to incubating young companies and nonprofits, the Lean Lab might be able to bring some disillusioned educators back into the classroom.
And I'm Gina Kaufman. We just heard from Ben Palisari, who visited the Lean Lab to investigate what's going on, what's innovative going on in education right now. And we're back in the Central Standards studio with Allison Heil, Director of Language Services for Kansas City Public Schools, Asael Leon, who is a student who went through the English language learning courses that we're talking about today, and Paul Markham, Associate Professor from the Department of Curriculum and Teaching at the University of Kansas School of Education. One of the proposals Ben heard when he visited the Lean Lab was a proposal that sought to solve what the participant perceived as a problem of intake for English language learners. How are schools currently identifying students who will need to be part of this program, Paul Markham, and why is that a challenge?
Well, initially it's usually based on some sort of home language survey, which is simply identifying which language the child speaks at home most of the time prior to entering the school system. And then when identified in that way, then there's further testing. Like I say, the states have their own assessments or English language assessments that they use to determine the level of the student's ability coming into the school system and then to place them in appropriate services based on that assessment. So that's how it's done on the whole nationally.
This teacher perceives an issue, or this former teacher rather, that some students are in a classroom not having been identified for a certain period of time, falling further and further behind before anyone realizes that this person needs help learning English. Allison Heil, is that something that you have witnessed in the classrooms?
That does happen. I think we have worked very hard as a department and as a district to cut down on that issue. We do have kind of central enrollment. So English language learners are sent to our department so that we can take care of that kind of issue. We get them a language screener when they enroll with us. We send the paperwork to the school and the teacher so they know that the student is coming, what language level they are, where to place them in a schedule or a program, particularly at the secondary level and at the elementary level, just to let them know where the student is coming from and their language level. We have actually, the teacher that you're referring to was one of our teachers. He just ended his two-year TFA fellowship.
TFA, that's Teach for America.
Teach for America, mm-hmm. And came to us at the end of the school year with the idea of what do we need? What could language services use? And one of the things that is very valuable but hard to put together, takes a lot of manpower, is finding like a native language screener for students. So finding out what their level of math is in their native language, finding out what their level of native language literacy is. That information is so valuable for teachers, but we don't have the manpower to create that, or a teacher can't do that necessarily on their own. So that's
what's hard about generating that. Can you explain the challenge there?
Well, we don't always have the language staff that can do that at a large scale level. Certainly a teacher that gets in a student from Burma may need some help putting together a native language literacy test or finding a math placement test and getting that to the student. So what we're trying to create on a wide scale level is native language placement tests, math placement tests, so that a teacher could, if a student does enroll at the school site, which shouldn't happen but sometimes does, they can get those screeners to the student and place them appropriately more quickly than for us to find them.
So when you talk about someone enrolling at the school site, that's they just show up for the first
sometimes
day?
Sometimes that happens. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The families hear from other families. They know that their school is in their neighborhood, so they go to that school thinking that's where they should enroll, and that's fine. And we have things in place or checks in place to find those students. But if the school can identify them first right off the bat, then everyone is better off for it.
Paul Markham, nationally, is there anything being developed? Allison was just mentioning a challenge of like a teacher can't possibly know all of these languages, and therefore that teacher can't create his or her own assessment of how fluent a student is in his or her native language. So, for example, would there be some sort of national set of tests, for example, where you could have the test to assess a Burmese student versus an Arabic speaker or what have you?
By and large, I would say no, with the exception of Spanish. There are actually many Spanish language tests that are available that could assess your knowledge in various content areas, that are academically related. But in most other languages, that isn't the case. And another complication there is that, actually that makes no sense to try to test the person bilingually unless the person is already bilingual in their home language, in the sense that they read the language, they have literacy skills in their home language, and they have been taught that content in their home language. In other words, if you learn the content for the first time in the context of the United States, you don't know math concepts as taught in your native language, or social studies concepts, or science concepts, or anything else. It really depends on the amount of prior schooling they have and their prior literacy skills in their own native language, whatever that happens to be. So that's a further complication to what we're saying. And then it also, because you have a lot of commercially developed tests for this purpose, there isn't a lot of commercial incentive to, create content-based language tests that could be marketed nationally for Burmese, or name your, small ethnic group within the context of the United States, because it's not going to be widely used enough to make it cost effective. So that's another problem with this as to why they aren't available. But first of all, you have to assume prior literacy in the native language, and the fact that they've had some kind of content instruction, in fact, in their native language, or the trying to give them an assessment in their native language makes no sense in those content areas, at least.
Is there any current thinking about how to overcome this problem?
We do have in many places. I can use, again, Kansas City, Missouri, or Kansas City, Kansas, as an example. I'm a little more familiar with the setup over there, obviously. And they do have paraprofessionals, aides, assistants who speak some other languages, but many of them are Spanish-speaking. So if you need some bilingual support in Spanish, that certainly exists fairly easily. And they do have, again, refugees from a number of other countries, such as is the case with Kansas City, Missouri. I think over 50 language groups last time I heard, and they have had some historical help in like Laotian, because they had a fairly large group from there, and now they're getting a lot of Somali students and students from all over the place, which is again the problem that Allison has pointed out earlier. But it's difficult to find those who have enough academic background themselves or professional training in it to some extent, and then also the highly skilled sort of native speaker ability in those various languages to fairly represent a large number of languages within the school district with paraprofessionals who are skilled at using those languages. That's very difficult to do.
Paul, we've received an email from someone in the Kansas City, Kansas school district. We hear that Kansas City, Kansas has a large ESL population, that it's almost 40% of the student population, and that the majority are U.S. born, with Spanish being a majority and Burmese and Nepali populations being the most the quickest growing refugee populations. I wonder if you can address, you've talked about that there are resources for Spanish speakers just because that is such a majority that don't exist for some of these other language groups. Is there any sort of proactive effort being made on behalf of these Burmese and Nepali populations?
Well, there usually are as they initially immigrate. They're sponsored by some organization, one or the other, and they kind of help the transition into the United States, and sometimes they have people within those organizations who, they themselves were refugees from that country earlier, or immigrants from that country earlier, so they get some support that way. Like I said, but and there are, I'm sure, if, as those two populations increase within Kansas City, Kansas schools, Burmese and Nepali speakers that I'm sure they try to seek out bilingual aides or paraprofessionals who can assist somewhat with those languages. But like I said, it really these are not certified teachers. These are people who are adults who have some kind of college background, typically, but not necessarily education majors, not certified teachers. And they are obviously native speakers of the language in question, and then they're sort of assisting the students in their transition into the English-speaking environment and the school system.
Well,
but to say that there's some quick or easy fix to this when you're talking about multiple languages, I don't know that that's, you know, realistic.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Gina Kaufman. You've just been hearing the voice of Paul Markham. He comes to us from the University of Kansas School of Education. I'm also joined in the studio by Allison Heil, Director of Language Services for Kansas City Public Schools, and Asael Leon, who has been through the English as a Second Language, English Language Learning programs in the Kansas City Public Schools. We are also getting calls, and you're welcome to join in the conversation, though we don't have much time. Robert in Midtown Kansas City has called 816-235-2888. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Gina. Thank you for taking my call.
Welcome to Central Standard. What can you share with us?
Well, I've been involved with the program since 2004 through the Greater Kansas City Hispanic Collaborative and the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce of Kansas City, working with children of foreign-born parents. And many of the things that were highlighted here are the same issues that we have. We're a community-based organization primarily run by volunteers. And I just see that under the current administration, we've had problems in getting extra funding for ESL programs, with Hispanics and the foreign-born community being the fastest-growing segment of the educational public schools. We need to make sure that we get additional funding for that program.
All right. Thanks, Robert. So I wonder, Paul, can you weigh in on funding issues, how politics can affect this? Do you agree with what you've heard Robert say, first of all?
I would agree. I mean, most of the funding efforts are targeting, of course, there's the public school money that comes through identification, among other things, identifying the students and then providing a program for them. And the state of Kansas, actually, there are some built-in financial incentives for identifying the students initially. And then also for any teachers who pursue ESOL endorsements, there's a little built-in financial incentive for the school district to help teachers pursue their ESOL endorsements. But as to sort of community outreach organizations beyond that, I know that funding for those kinds of things exists, but it's sporadic and more difficult to obtain because it's not sort of, you know, built within a financial structure such as the state budget. The state legislature has a budget that must be dedicated to education, and therefore they will provide financial resources of some sort, and some of those resources can be used for the English language learners, of course.
All right.
It's probably more of a grant-based kind of situation where it's a competitive basis and you have to apply for it, and hopefully you're one of those who receives the grant.
Allison, listening to all of this, there's something that we haven't touched on that is, are all students who need language support getting that support? Is there a level of language proficiency that might be in between coming in with no language ability and speaking kind of a broken English that's not quite caught up to where it needs to be?
I would say that what we've been noticing over the last couple of years, and this is happening nationwide, I think California was probably first to identify it, is we have students that have kind of plateaued or fossilized at intermediate language level, but they're certainly not intermediate in terms of how long they've been in the country. We call them long-term English language learners, and they have been with us 6 or more years. They may have been born in the country, and they've kind of plateaued at an intermediate language level and at an academic level. And so we're certainly working on identifying best strategies and best practices for those students.
And Asael, you've been sitting here listening to people talk about an experience you have been through. And I wonder if that issue of being given the tools you need to succeed for as long as you needed them, do you feel like you had support for as long as you needed it?
Of course. Of course, I always had support. To me, I felt like it was easier because I had all these teachers that, you know, helped me out with things, you know. Actually, for me, it didn't take that long to get out of the ESL program. If I can remember, it was like 3 years.
What are you doing now?
I'm studying at JCC.
What are you studying?
I'm studying for business administration right now.
Well, that is all the time we have for today's conversation. Thanks so much to all of our guests for joining in the conversation on the first day of school, no less. Allison Heil of Kansas City Public Schools, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And Paul Markham, Associate Professor at the Department of Curriculum and Teaching at the University of Kansas School of Education. We loved having you too. And Asael Leon, best of luck.
Thank you very much.
To listen back to today's show or any past conversations you've heard on Central Standard, go to kcur.org/centralstandard. You can also follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @KCURCST. Tomorrow, tune in at 10 to hear how music triggers memories for all of us, but especially for dementia and Alzheimer's patients. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross with lots of help from Matt Hodep and Christina Leffring. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's it for today. Stick around for Up to Date. Next.